way that the sixth formers do in the common room, except with much more enthusiasm. There are not many books. It's actually more of a large room with a few bookshelves than a library. The atmosphere is quite strange. I'm almost glad that it's so bright and happy in here. It's an odd feeling, because I never like bright and happy things. We sit down in the middle of the non-fiction row. He's looking at me, but I don't want to look back anymore. Looking at his face makes me feel funny. "You were hiding yesterday," he says, trying to make it sound like a cute joke, as if we're 6 years old. For a second, I wonder if he knows about my special beautiful place on the art conservatory roof. But that's impossible. "How's your arm?" he asks. "It's fine," I say. "Didn't you have something to tell me?" And the pause he leaves then. It's like he has everything he wants to tell me, and nothing. "Are you all..." he begins, then changes his mind. "Your hands are cold." I stare blankly at my hands, still avoiding his eyes. Had he been holding my hand on the way here? I curl my palms into fists and sigh. Fine, small talk it is. "I watched all three Lord of the Rings last night, and V for Vendetta. Oh, and I had a dream. I think it was about Winona Ryder." And I can feel the sadness pouring out of him all of a sudden, and it makes me want to get up and run away and keep running. "I also found out that approximately 100 billion people have died since the world began. Did you know that? 100 billion. It's a big number, but it still doesn't seem like quite enough." There's a long silence. A few of the lower school groups are looking at us and giggling, thinking we're having some kind of deep romantic conversation. Finally, he says something productive. "I guess neither of us has been sleeping much." I decide to look at him then. It shocks me a little, because there's none of the usual Michael in that calm smile, and I think of the time at the ice rink when he'd been so angry, but it's different from that. And I think of the sadness that's been in Lucas's eyes since the day I met him, but it's different from that too. Split between the green and the blue, there is an indefinable beauty that people call humanity. "You don't have to do this anymore," I'm whispering. Not because I don't want people to hear, but I seem to have forgotten how to increase the volume in my voice. "You don't have to be my friend. I don't want people to feel sorry for me. I'm literally 110% fine. Really. I understand what you've been trying to do, and you are a very nice person. You're the perfect person, actually. But it's okay. You don't have to pretend anymore. I'm fine. I don't need you to help me. I'll do something about all this, and then I'll be all right, and it'll all go back to normal." His face doesn't change. He reaches toward me with his hand and brushes what must be a tear from my face. Not in a romantic way, but as if I had a malaria-carrying mosquito perched on my cheek. He looks at the tear, somewhat confused, and then holds his hand up to me. I hadn't realized I was crying. I don't really feel sad. I don't really feel anything. "I'm not a perfect person," he says. His smile is still there, but it's not a happy smile. "And I don't have any friends except for you." In case you hadn't heard, most people know that I'm the king of freaks. I mean, yeah, sometimes I come across as charming and eccentric, but eventually people realize that I'm just trying too hard. I'm sure Lucas Ryan and Nick Nelson can tell you all kinds of wonderful stories about me. He leans back. He looks annoyed, to be honest. If you don't want to be friends with me, I completely understand. You don't have to make some excuse about it. I know that I'm the one who always comes to find you. I'm the one who always starts our conversations. Sometimes you don't say anything for ages. But that doesn't mean that our friendship is all about me trying to make you feel better. You know me better than that. Maybe I don't want to be friends with Michael Holden. Maybe that's better. We sit together for a while. I randomly select a book from the shelf behind me. It's called The Encyclopedia of Life, and it can only be about 50 pages long. Michael reaches out his hand toward me, but doesn't, as I anticipate, take my own hand. Instead, he takes hold of a strand of my hair, which, I guess, had sort of been in my face, and he tucks it carefully behind my left ear. Did you know, I say at some point, for some inexplicable reason, that most suicides happen in the springtime? Then I look at him. Didn't you say you had news? And that's when he gets up and walks away from me, and out of the library door, and out of my life, and I am 100% sure that Michael Holden deserves better friends than the pessimist, introvert, psychopath, Tori Spring. Chapter 13. The song repeating itself over the loudspeaker throughout Thursday is The Final Countdown by Europe. Most people enjoy this for the first hour, but by second period, no one is screaming, "It's the final countdown!" in the hallways anymore, much to my delight, if that's possible for me. Zelda and her entourage are once again strutting through the hallways, tearing posters from the walls. And today, these include pictures of Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Abraham Lincoln, Emmeline Pankhurst, Winston Churchill, and, oddly enough, Christmas chart toppers Rage Against the Machine. Perhaps Solitaire is attempting to offer us some sort of positive encouragement. It has been snowing violently since I woke up. This, of course, sparks mass hysteria and insanity in everyone in the lower school, and a kind of collective depression in everyone in the upper school. Most of the students have gone home by break, and lessons are officially cancelled. I could easily walk home, but I don't. Tomorrow is the day. At the start of what would have been period three, I exit the school building and head toward the art conservatory. I sit down, leaning against the little grass slope that leads up to the room's concrete wall. And the roof above me overhangs a little, so I'm not really getting snowed on. It's cold, though, like numbingly cold. On my way outside, I picked up a large heater from the music block and plugged it in via a classroom window a few meters away. I've got it nestled into the snow next to me, blasting clouds of warmth around my body. I have three shirts on, both of my school jumpers, four pairs of tights, boots, blazer, coat, hat, scarf, and gloves, and shorts under my skirt. If I don't find out what's happening tomorrow before tomorrow, then I'll have to come to school and find out on the day. Solitaire is going to do something to Higgs. It's what it's been doing all the way up until now, isn't it? I feel strangely excited. It's probably because I haven't slept for quite a long time. Last night, I watched a film called Garden State. Not all of it, but most of it. It really surprised me that I hadn't seen it before, because I thought it was absolutely excellent in every possible way. And I mean that. I gave it a spot in my top films list. It's about this guy, Andrew, and you're never quite sure whether Andrew's life is truly depressing or not. It seems like he has no decent friends or family. But then he meets this girl, typically happy-go-lucky, quirky and beautiful, manic pixie dream girl, Natalie Portman, of course, who teaches him how to live properly again. You know, now that I think about it, I'm not so sure that I liked the film so much after all. It was very cliché. To be honest, I may have just got myself caught up in the artistic effects. It was good at the beginning, especially when Andrew dreamt that he was in a plane crash, and the shot where he wears a shirt that matches the wallpaper print behind him so he sort of fades away. I like those bits a lot. It's very obvious that Zach Braff, who wrote, directed, acted, and compiled the soundtrack, created this film about himself. Maybe that's what made it so real to me. I keep typing Michael's number into my phone and then deleting it. After about 10 minutes of this, I realize that I know his number by heart. I curse myself for acting like such a dumb teenage girl. Then I accidentally press the green call button. I swear resignedly at myself. But I don't hang up. I bring the phone up to my ear. I hear the little click of the call being answered, but he doesn't say hello or anything. He listens. I think I hear him breathing, but it might just be the wind. "Hello, Michael," I finally say. Nothing. "I'm going to talk, so you can't hang up." Nothing. "Sometimes," I say. "I can't tell whether people are real or not. Lots of people pretend to be nice to me, so I'm never sure." Nothing. I'm fairly angry at you, Tori, to be honest. He speaks. The words circle around my head and I want to roll over and throw up. "You don't see me as a person at all, do you?" he says. "I'm just some tool who's always turning up to stop you hating yourself so much." "That's wrong," I say. "That's completely wrong." "Prove it." I try to speak, but nothing comes out. My proof is shrouded by something like snow, and I can't get it out. I can't explain that, yes, he stops me hating myself so much. But no, that isn't why I want to be his friend more than I've ever wanted anything. He laughs weakly. "You're pretty hopeless, aren't you? You're as bad as I am at feelings." I try to think about when Michael might have expressed his feelings, but the only time I can think of is at the ice rink. That anger, so crazy that he might explode. "Can we meet up?" I ask. I need to talk to him, in the real world. "Why?" "Because..." Once again, my voice is trapped in my throat. "Because I like being with you." There's a long pause. For a brief moment, I wonder if he hung up. Then he sighs. "Where are you right now?" he asks. "Have you gone home?" "On the field by the Art Conservatory. But it's literally hot out there." A Star Wars reference. It takes me so by surprise that I once again fail to say anything in reply. "I'll see you in a minute," he says. I hang up. He's here in almost exactly a minute, which is impressive. He's not wearing a coat or a scarf or anything over his uniform. I think that he may secretly be a radiator. Several meters away, he absorbs the situation. I suppose it's funny, and that's why he laughs. You took a heater outside. I look at the heater. I am freezing. He thinks I'm insane. He's not wrong. That is genius. I don't even think I would do that. He sits next to me, leaning against the art conservatory's outer wall. We stare over the field. It's uncertain, really, where the field stops and the sheet-like snowflakes begin. The snow is falling slowly and vertically. I would say that there is total peace on earth, except that every now and then a solitary snowflake flies into my face. At some point, he glances down at my left arm, which is resting on the snow between us. He doesn't say anything about it. You had news to tell me, I say. It's pretty amazing that I even remember this. But you didn't tell me. His head turns to me, his smile absent. Yeah, well, it's not too important. That means that it is important. I just wanted to tell you that I have another race in a few weeks, he says, a little embarrassed. I'm going to the World Junior Speed Skating Championships. He shrugs and smiles. I mean, the British never win, but if I get a good enough time score there, I might qualify for the Youth Winter Olympics. I spring forward from the wall. Holy shit! He shrugs again. I mucked up nationals a couple of weeks ago, but I've gotten better times than that before, so they decided to let me go. Michael, I say, you're literally extraordinary. He laughs. Extraordinary is only an extension of ordinary, he says. He's wrong, though. He is extraordinary. Extraordinary as in magnificent, as in miraculous. So, would you like to? He asks. Like to what? I ask. Would you like to come? To watch? I'm allowed to take someone, and usually it's a parent, but, you know. And without thinking, without wondering whether my parents would say yes, without even worrying about Charlie. Yeah, I say, okay. He grins at me. And then I see a new expression that makes my chest hurt. A kind of raw gratitude, as if me going with him was the only thing that mattered. I open my mouth to begin a serious conversation, but he sees it coming and holds up a finger to stop me. We are severely wasting this snow, he says. I can see myself in his glasses. Wasting? He jumps onto 2 feet and walks into the blizzard. Snow shouldn't be just to look at, should it? He says, rolling a snowball in his hands and tossing it from one to the other. I say nothing because I think that's exactly what snow should be for. Come on! He's smiling, gawking at me. Throw a snowball at me. I frown. Why? For no reason. There's no point. The point is that there's no point. I sigh. I am not going to win this argument. Begrudgingly, I stand up, step out into the Arctic, and with little enthusiasm, collect a ball of snow in my hands. Luckily, I'm right-handed, so my injured arm doesn't really put me at a disadvantage. I throw it toward Michael, where it lands about 3 meters to his right. He looks at it and gives me a solemn thumbs up acceptingly. You tried. There's something about the way he says it. Not even patronizing, just simply disappointed, that makes me squint at him, pick up another snowball, and try again, this time landing bang on target in the center of his chest. A false sense of achievement blossoms in my stomach. Raising his arms in the air, he cries, "You're alive!" I throw another snowball. Then he throws one at me and runs away. Before I even have time to realize what I'm doing, The whole thing erupts into a chase around the field. I fall over more than once, but I manage to stuff snow down the back of his shirt 2 times, and he gets me right in the back of the head, so my hair is now soaked. But I don't feel so cold because we're running around face first into the swirling snow like there is nothing else in the world but the two of us and snow and more snow and more snow. No ground, no sky, no nothing. I begin to wonder how Michael can so easily make something wonderful out of something cold. And then I begin to wonder whether lots of people are like this. And I begin to wonder whether, if I wasn't so busy thinking about other things, I would be like this. Michael Holden is sprinting toward me. He's got a massive pile of snow in his arms and this psychotic grin. So I charge back across the field and into school. There's no one anywhere, and the emptiness is somehow wonderful. I run into the sixth form block and into the common room, which is entirely deserted, but I'm much too slow. Just as I open the common room doors, he lets the slush tumble onto the top of my head. I scream and laugh. 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 I lie face up, panting, on a computer desk, moving the keyboard onto my stomach to make room. He collapses into a swivel chair, shaking his hair like a wet dog. The chair rolls backward several inches, and it sparks an idea in his head. "Here's the next game," he says. "You have to get from here," he gestures to the computer corner, "to there," the door on the opposite side, "past the maze of tables and chairs, standing on a computer chair." "I'd rather not break my neck." "Stop being boring. You're banned from saying no."
"But that's my catchphrase."
"Make a new one." With a long sigh, I step up onto a swivel chair. This is a lot more difficult than it looks, because not only are swivel chairs very wobbly, but they also spin around, hence the name swivel chair. I gain my balance, stand tall, and point at Michael, who has stood up on his own chair with his arms warily outstretched.
"When I fall and die, I am coming back to haunt you."
He shrugs at me. "That wouldn't be so bad." We race all the way around the tables, grasping at the plastic chairs to haul ourselves along. At one point, Michael's chair tips up, but he spectacularly manages to step forward over the back of the seat, landing before me in a sort of kneeling position. His face, wide-eyed, rests in a fairly stunned expression for several seconds before he beams up at me, throwing open his arms and crying, "Marry me, my darling!" It's so funny, I nearly die. He comes over to me and starts spinning around the chair I'm standing on. Not fast, but fast enough, and then he lets go. I'm standing up, twirling around and around on this chair, with my arms in the air, the windows of snow merging with the unlit room in a slushy vortex of white and yellow. I keep thinking as I'm spinning how everything looks so sad. But if this day were to go down in history, everyone would talk about what a beautiful day it was. We've pushed all the spare desks together to form one enormous table, and we're laid out in the middle on our backs, just under the skylight, so that we can see the snow falling on top of us. Michael rests his hands on his stomach, locked together, and I lay mine out beside me. I have no idea what we're doing or why. I think he thinks that's the point. To be honest, this could all be imaginary, and I wouldn't even know. "Thought for the day," says Michael. He lifts one hand and touches the bandage on my arm, fiddling with the frayed edges at my wrist. "Do you think that if we were happy for our entire lives, we would die feeling like we'd missed out on something?" I do not say anything for some time. Then, "They were from you." those blog messages, those messages that I'd assumed.
You send me those messages.
He smiles, keeping his eyes on the ceiling.
What can I say?
Your blog is more interesting than you think it is, chronic pessimist.
My blog URL.
Normally, I'd feel like dying if someone found my blog. If Becky, or Lauren, or Evelyn, or Rita, or any of those people, if they found the place where I say stupid stuff about myself, pretending that I'm some unfortunate and tortured teenage soul, begging for sympathy from people who I've never even seen in the flesh.
I roll my head toward him. He looks at me.
What?
I almost say something then. I almost say something. But I don't. And then he says, I wish I were more like you. And the snow falls, and I close my eyes, and we fall asleep together. I wake up and he's gone, and I'm in the dark, alone. No, not alone. There's someone here. Someone. Here?
As my senses come back to me, I begin to decipher hushed voices coming from the common room door. If I had any energy, I would sit up and look. But I don't. I lie still and listen.
No, says Michael. You've been acting like a little shit. You can't fuck around with someone like that. Do you understand how she's feeling at the moment? Do you understand what you've done?
Yeah, but you give the full explanation or you say nothing. You be honest or you shut the fuck up. Dropping little hints and then hiding is literally the worst thing you could do.
I haven't been dropping little hints.
What have you said to her?
Because she knows, Lucas. She knows there's something going on.
I've tried to explain.
No, you haven't. So you're going to go and tell her everything you've just told me. You owe that to her. She's a real person, not some childhood dream. She has real feelings.
There's a long pause.
Jesus fucking Christ, this is a fucking revelation.
I haven't heard Michael swear so much, all in one conversation. I haven't heard Michael and Lucas talk to each other since Pizza Express.
I don't think I want to know what they're talking about.
I sit up, still on the table, and swivel round to face the two boys. They're standing in front of the door, Michael holding it by one hand. Lucas sees me first, then Michael. Michael looks a little like he's going to be sick. He takes Lucas firmly by the shoulder and shoves him toward me.
If you are going to do anything about anything, he says, addressing me, pointing viciously at Lucas, you need to talk to him.
Lucas is terrified. I half expect him to scream like a girl. Michael triumphantly raises his fist in the air in a Judd Nelson-like fashion.
Closure!
He bellows, and then he leaves the room. It is just Lucas and me now, my former best friend, the boy who cried every day, and Tori Spring. Standing beside my table island, wrapped in a kind of parka over his uniform, he's wearing one of those hats with the really long plaits hanging down at the front and looks absolutely hysterical. I cross my legs like you do in primary school. There is no time for being awkward now. No time for being shy or being scared what other people would say. It's time to start saying the things that are in our heads. Everything that would cause us to hold back, it's gone. And we are only people. And this is the truth.
Your new bestie is crazy, says Lucas with noticeable resentment.
I shrug. Michael at Truam. Michael with no friends.
Apparently, everyone already knew that.
Michael the Freak.
To be honest, I think it's just a defense mechanism.
This seems to surprise Lucas.
I snort a little and lie back onto the tables.
So you owe me an explanation, I say in a dramatic voice.
But it's too funny, and I start to laugh. He chuckles, takes his hat off and puts it in his pocket, and folds his arms.
To be honest, Victoria, I can't believe you haven't guessed.
Well then, I must be some kind of idiot.
Yeah. Silence. We're both totally still.
You do know,
he says, taking another step closer.
You need to think carefully. You need to think about all the things that have happened.
I get to my feet and step backward. There is nothing inside my head, except fog now. Lucas clambers onto the table island and walks a little way across toward me, nervously, as if he's scared they're just going to collapse under his weight. He tries to explain again.
Do you remember ever coming to my house when we were kids?
I really want to laugh, but I can't anymore. He looks down a little and sees a bandage on my arm, and it almost seems to make him shudder.
We were best friends, yeah?
He says, but that means nothing. Becky was my best friend.
Best friend, what does that indicate?
What? I shake my head. What are you talking about?
You do remember,
he says, his voice barely above a whisper.
If I remember, then you remember. Tell me about when you came round my house all those times. Tell me what you saw there.
He's right. I do remember. I wish I didn't. It was summer. We were 11 and it was nearing the end of year 6. I went round his house what felt like 100 times. We played chess. We sat in the garden. We ate ice lollies. We ran all around his house. It was a big house. 3 floors with an abundance of hiding places. Everything was kind of beige. They had a lot of paintings. A lot of paintings. They had a lot of paintings. And there is one that I remember. I asked Lucas when I was 11.
Is that a painting of the high street?
Yep,
he said. He was smaller than me back then, his hair white blonde.
The cobbled high street in the rain.
I like the red umbrellas, I said. I think it must be summer rain.
I think so too.
The painting of the wet, cobbled street with red umbrellas and warm cafe windows. The painting that Doctor Who girl was staring at so intensely at the solitaire party. It is inside Lucas's house. I begin to breathe very fast.
That painting, I say.
He says nothing.
But the solitaire party, that wasn't your house. You don't live in this town.
No, he says. My parents are in real estate. They own several empty houses. That house was one of them. They put those paintings in there to brighten it up for viewers.
Everything suddenly clicks into place. You're part of solitaire, I say. He nods slowly.
I made it, says Lucas. I made solitaire.
I step back. No, I say. No, you didn't.
I made that blog.
I organized the pranks. Star Wars, violins, cats, Madonna, Ben Hope and Charlie. Fire,
Bubbles. The fireworks at the clay and the burning and the distorted voice. Surely I would have recognized his voice. I step back. You're lying.
I'm not.
I step back, but there isn't any table to step back onto, and my foot falls onto air, and I topple backward into nothingness, only to be caught under my arms by Michael Holden, who has been standing by us since God knows when. He lifts me a little and settles me on the ground. His hands feel strange on my arms.
I can't speak. I'm choking. My throat is closing.
You are a sadistic.
I know. I'm sorry. It all got a bit out of hand.
Got a bit out of hand? I shriek with laughter. People could have died. Michael's arms are around me. I throw him off, climb back onto the tables, and march toward Lucas, who cowers a little as I face him.
All the pranks were related to me, weren't they?
I say this more to myself than him. Michael had realized this right from the start.
Because he's clever. He's so clever. And I, being me, didn't bother to listen to anyone except myself.
Lucas nods.
Why did you make solitaire?
I say. He can't breathe. His mouth turns in and he swallows.
I'm in love with you, he says.
At that moment, I consider many options. One is to punch him in the face. Another is to jump out of the window. The option that I go with is to run. So now I'm running. You don't pull pranks on a school because you're in love with someone. You don't get a whole party to attack someone because you're in love with someone. I'm running through our school, into and out of classrooms I've never entered, through dark and empty corridors I never pass through anymore. All the while Lucas is in pursuit, crying out that he wants to explain properly, as if there's more to explain. There isn't more to explain. He's a psycho, like everyone. He doesn't care that people get hurt. Like everyone. I find myself at a dead end in the art department. It's a room that I stood on top of only 2 days ago, the art conservatory. I dart around the room, desperately looking for somewhere to go, as Lucas stands breathing heavily at the door. The windows are too small to jump out of.
Sorry, he says, still panting, hands on his knees. Sorry. That was kind of sudden. That didn't make any sense.
I practically screech with laughter.
You think?
Am I allowed to explain properly?
I look at him. Is this the final explanation? He stands up straight.
Yes. Yes, it is.
I sit down on a stool. He sits on the stool next to mine. I edge away but don't say anything. He begins his story.
I never forgot anything about you. Every time we drove down your road, I would look at your house, pretty much praying that you'd step out of your door at just the right moment. I used to come up with all these scenarios where I would contact you and we would be friends again. Like we'd find each other on Facebook and start chatting and decide to meet up. Or we'd meet randomly somewhere in the high street at a party. I don't know. When I grew older, you became like that one girl, you know? The one girl who I would end up having that great romance with. We start as childhood friends. We'd meet again, older. And that would be it. Happily ever after. Like a film. But you're not the Victoria I had in my head. I don't know. You're someone else. Someone I don't know, I guess. I don't know what I was thinking. Look, I'm not a stalker or anything. I came for a tour of Higgs last term to see if I liked it, you know. Michael showed me round.
He took me all over the school, and the last place I visited was the common room. And, that's where I saw you, sitting literally right in front of me. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. You were on a computer, but you had your back to me. You were sitting there at the computer, playing solitaire. And you looked so... You had one hand on your head, and the other just clicking and clicking the mouse. And you looked so dead. You looked tired and dead. And under your breath, you kept saying over and over, I hate myself. I hate myself. I hate myself. Not loud enough for anyone to hear except me. I don't remember this happening. I don't remember this day at all. It seems dumb now. I bet you were just stressed about coursework or something, but I couldn't stop thinking about it, and then I started to get all these ideas. I thought that maybe you really did hate yourself, and I hated the school for doing that to you. I literally went into rages thinking about it, and that's when I came up with solitaire. I talked to a guy I knew from Truham who'd joined Higgs, and we decided to start pulling pranks. I had this crazy, crazy idea that just a few small acts of hilarity might bring something bright into your life and into everyone's lives. So yeah, I organized the Ben Hope thing. I was so angry about what had happened to Charlie. Ben deserved that. But then the thing at the clay happened. People got injured. You got injured. It got out of control. So after that, I quit. I haven't done anything since Sunday. But there's so many followers now. We made them all take it so seriously, thinking they were anarchists or something, with the posters and the fireworks and the stupid slogans. I don't know. I don't know. Michael found me about half an hour ago. I know you're going to hate me now. But, he's right. It's worse for you if you don't know. Tears start to drift down his face, and I don't know what to do. Like when we were little. Always silent tears. I am the worst type of human being, Lucas says, and he puts his elbows on the table and looks away from me. Well, you're not getting any sympathy from me, I say. Because he gave up. Lucas gave up. He let these stupid imaginary feelings control his life, and he made bad things happen, very bad things, which caused other bad things to happen. This is the way the world works. This is why you never let your feelings control your behavior. I'm angry. I'm angry that Lucas didn't fight against his feelings. But that's the way the world works. Lucas stands up and I flinch away. Stay away from me, I find myself saying, like he's a rabid animal. I can't believe it took until now for me to realize the truth. He's not Lucas Ryan to me anymore. Victoria, I saw you that day and thought that the person who I'd been in love with for 6 years was going to kill herself. Don't touch me. Stay away from me. Nobody is honest. Nobody is real. You can't trust anyone or anything. Emotions are humanity's fatal disease, and we're all dying. Look, I'm not part of solitaire anymore. You were so innocent and awkward. I'm talking in rushed, maniacal strings of thought. I don't know why I'm saying any of this. It's not really Lucas I'm angry at. I suppose you thought you were romantic with your books and your fucking hipster clothes. Why shouldn't I be in love with you? All this time you were plotting and faking. Why am I surprised? This is what everyone does. And then I know exactly what to do.
What, I ask, is Solitaire going to do tomorrow?
I have the chance to do something, to finally, wonderfully put an end to all the pain. He says nothing, so I shout.
Tell me what's happening tomorrow.
I don't know exactly, says Lucas, but I think he's lying. All I know is that they're meeting inside at 6 a.m.
So that's where I'll be, tomorrow at 6. I'll undo everything.
Why didn't you tell me that before?
I whisper.
Why didn't you tell anyone?
There is no answer. He cannot answer. The sadness is coming, like a storm. And I start to laugh like a serial killer. I laugh and run out of the school, run through this dead town, run, and I think, maybe the pain will stop. But it keeps burning inside, burning down.
Chapter 14. The 4th of February is a Friday. The UK experiences the heaviest snowfall since 1963. Approximately 360,000 people are born, and lightning strikes the earth 518,400 times. 154,080 people die. I escape my house at 5:24 a.m. I did not watch any films during the night. None of them seemed very interesting. Also, my room was kind of freaking me out because I pulled down all the solitaire posts, so my carpet was now a meadow of paper and blue tack. I just kind of sat on my bed, not doing anything. Anyway, I'm wearing as many clothes as possible over my school uniform, and I'm armed with my phone and a torch and an unopened diet lemonade can, which I don't think I'll drink. I'm feeling slightly deranged because I haven't slept for about a week. But it's a good sort of deranged. An ecstatic deranged. An invincible, infinite deranged. The Solitaire blog post appeared at 8 p.m. last night. 20:00, 3rd of February. Solitarians. Tomorrow morning, Solitaire's greatest operation will take place at Harvey Green Grammar School. You are most welcome to attend. Thank you for all your support this term. Our former leader never truly explained the creation of Solitaire. We hope that we've added something to what might have been a very boring January. Patience kills. I have a sudden urge to call Becky.
Hello?
Becky sleeps with her phone on vibrate next to her head. I know this because she used to tell me how boys wake her up in the night by texting her.
Becky, it's Tori.
Oh my God, Tori. She does not sound very alive.
Why are you calling me at 5 a.m.?
It's 5:40. Well, that changes everything. That's a 40-minute difference. You can do a lot in 40 minutes.
Just why
are you calling? To say I'm feeling a lot better. Pause. Well, that's good, but... Yeah, I know. I feel really, really, really good.
Then shouldn't you be sleeping?
Yeah, I will, once I've sorted things out for good. It's happening this morning. Solitaire, you know. Second pause. Wait. She's awake now. Wait. What? Where are you? I look around. I'm nearly there, actually. Heading to school? Why? Oh, my God! There's some scuffling of her sitting up in her bed.
Jesus Christ, dude! What the fuck are you doing?
I already told you. Tori, just go home.
Go home?
I laugh. And do what? Cry some more?
Are you literally insane? It's 5 a.m.
What are you even trying to...
I stop laughing and press the red button because she is making me tear up. My feet sink into the snow as I hurry through town. I'm pretty sure that at some point I'm going to take a step and my foot won't stop. It'll just keep sinking down through the snow until I've disappeared entirely. If it wasn't for the street lights, it would be pitch black. But the lights are painting the white with a dull yellowish glow. The snow looks sick, diseased. 15 minutes later, I push my way through a hedge to get into school because the main gates are locked. I get a big old scratch on my face, and upon inspection using my phone screen, I decide I quite like it. The car park is deserted. I trudge through the snow toward the main entrance, and as I draw closer, I see that the door is ajar. I head inside, immediately noticing the white burglar and fire alarm box on the wall, or what used to be a white box on the wall. It's been torn away and is hanging from the plaster by only a couple of wires. The rest of the wires have all been cut. I stare at it for a few seconds before moving on down a corridor. They're here. I drift for a while, a ghost of Christmas past. I'm reminded of the last time I was here at a stupid hour of the day, weeks ago, with the prefects and Zelda and the violin video. That seems like a long time ago. Everything seems colder now. As I draw closer toward the end of the corridor, I begin to hear unintelligible whispers coming from the corner English classroom. Mr. Kent's classroom. I flatten myself like a spy against the wall by the door. There's a light glaring from its plastic window. Carefully and slowly, I peer into the room. I expect to find a horde of solitaire minions, but what I see instead are three figures huddled by a cluster of tables in the middle of the room, illuminated by an oversized torch shining upward from the table. The first is the guy with the large quiff, who I've seen Lucas with 100 times, in a very Lucas-ish hipster get-up, skinnies, boat shoes, bomber jacket, and Ben Sherman polo. The second person is Evelyn Foley. Quiff has his arm around her. Oh, Evelyn's secret boyfriend is Quiff. I think back to the clay. Had the solitaire voice been a girl's? It's too cold for me to remember anything, so I focus my attention on the third figure. Lucas. Quiff and Evelyn seem to be kind of ganging up on him. Lucas is whispering hurriedly at Quiff. He told me he wasn't a part of solitaire anymore, didn't he? Maybe I should jump into the room and start shouting, waving my phone, threatening to call the police. Maybe. Oh my God! At the other end of the corridor, Becky Allen blinks into existence and I almost collapse. She points at me with an accusatory finger and hisses, "I knew you wouldn't go home." My eyes, wild and unfocused, spin crazily as she storms down the corridor. Soon, Becky is beside me, in Superman pajama bottoms, tucked into at least 3 pairs of socks and furry boots, along with a hoodie and a coat and all other kinds of woolly clothing. "She's here. Becky came here. For me." She looks very strange with no makeup on and her purplish hair all scraped into a greasy sort of bulb. And I don't know why or how this happens, but I am actually relieved that she's here.
"Oh my God, you're insane," she whispers. "You are psychotic."
And then she hugs me, and I let her. And for several seconds, I really feel like we're friends. She lets go, withdraws, and cringes.
"Dude, what have you done to your face?"
She lifts her sleeve and wipes it roughly against my cheek, and when she draws it away, it's stained red.
Then she smiles and shakes her head. I am reminded of the Becky I knew 3 years ago, before boys, before sex, before alcohol, before she started to move on, while I stayed exactly where I was. I point toward the door to the English room.
Look inside.
She tiptoes past me and looks, and her face opens up in horror.
Evelyn, what the... And why is Lucas?
Her mouth hangs wide open as a sudden realization arrives.
Is this solitaire?
She turns back to me and shakes her head.
This is too much mindfuckery for this time of day. I'm not even sure I'm actually awake.
Shh. I'm trying to listen to what they're saying. Becky dives past the door and we stand, hidden in the dark on either side of it. And by both carefully peering round the frame, we spy on the gathering. Vaguely, we begin to decipher a conversation. It is 6:04 a.m.
Grow some balls, Lucas.
Evelyn. She's wearing high-waisted denim shorts and tights and one of those jackets with tartan lining.
I'm not even joking. We're terribly sorry to tear you away from your teddy bear and your electric blanket, but can't you just grow some balls?
Lucas's face, dotted with shadows, grimaces.
Can I please remind you that I am the one who started solitaire in the first place? Therefore, my balls are in no position to be questioned, thanks.
Yeah, you started it, says Quiff.
It's the first time I get a proper look at him, and for someone with such a large head of hair, he really is tiny. By his side on the table is a Morrison's shopping bag. His voice is also far more sophisticated than I'd anticipated.
And you left just when we started to do stuff that's actually worthwhile. We're doing something great. And yet here you are saying that everything you have worked for has been, and I quote, total and utter bullshit.
This isn't what I worked for, Lucas snaps. I thought that messing with this school would help people.
Fucking up this school, says Quiff, is the best thing that's ever happened to this town.
But this isn't going to help anyone. It's not going to change anything. Changing an environment doesn't change a person.
Cut the crap, Lucas.
Evelyn shakes her head.
You're not Gandhi, babe.
You must be able to see what an idiotic idea this is, says Lucas.
Just give me the lighter, says Quiff.
Becky, her palms flattened against the wall like Spider-Man, whips her head around.
Lighter?
She mouths. I shrug back. I stare harder at Lucas and realize that behind his back he's holding what at first looks like a gun, but is actually just one of those novelty lighters. There's only one thing you can do with a lighter.
No,
says Lucas. But even this far away, I can tell that he's nervous. Quiff lunges for Lucas's arm, but he steps backward just in time. Quiff begins to laugh like some evil mastermind.
Well, shit, says Quiff. You went through all this trouble, and now you're just going to steal our stuff and run off with it? Like a little kid?
Why did you even come here?
Why didn't you just go and tell on us like the baby you are?
Lucas shifts onto his other leg, silent.
Give me the lighter, says Quiff. Last chance.
Fuck you, says Lucas.
Quiff puts his hand to his face and rubs his forehead, sighing.
Christ.
Then, like someone flicked a switch in his brain, he swings his fist at lightning speed and punches Lucas in the face. Lucas, with surprising dignity, doesn't fall down. He lifts himself up to his full height and meets Quiff dead in the eye.
Fuck you, says Lucas again.
Quiff smashes Lucas in the stomach, this time doubling him over. He grabs Lucas's arm with ease and wrenches away the lighter gun, then grabs Lucas by the collar, holds the barrel against his neck, and pushes him against the wall.
I expect he thinks he looks like some kind of mafia boss, but it doesn't help him that he's got the face of a 7-year-old and the voice of David Cameron.
You couldn't just leave it, could you, mate? You couldn't just leave it alone, could you?
It's obvious that Quiff is not going to pull the trigger and burn Lucas's neck. It is obvious to Quiff that Quiff is not going to burn Lucas. It is obvious to all the people who have ever lived and all the people who will ever live that Quiff does not have the strength, will, or malice to seriously wound a fairly innocent guy like Lucas Ryan. But I guess if someone is holding a lighter gun up to your throat, then things like that aren't quite as obvious as they should be. Becky is no longer at my side. She karate kicks the door open.
Okay, chaps, just stop. Right now. Stop the madness.
With one hand in the air, she strides out from our hiding place. Evelyn makes some kind of squealing sound. Lucas lets out a triumphant laugh, and Quiff drops Lucas's collar and steps backward, as if afraid that Becky might arrest him right there on the spot. I follow her in and immediately regret it. Lucas sees me and stops laughing. Becky stomps up and places herself directly between Lucas and the lighter gun. Her makeupless face transforms her into a thin-eyed, pale-faced warrior. Oh, darling, she sighs at Quiff and tilts her head, faux sympathetically.
You actually think you're intimidating, don't you? I mean, where in God's name did you get that piece of crap? Cost-cutter?
Quiff tries to laugh it off but fails. Becky's eyes turn to fire. She holds out her hands.
Go for it, dude.
Her eyebrows are all the way up her forehead.
Go on, set fire to my hair or whatever. I am relatively intrigued to see if you can pull that trigger.
I can see Quiff desperately trying to think of something witty to say. After a few awkward moments, he stumbles backward, grabs a Morrison's bag, puts the lighter into it, and pulls the trigger. The lighter flame glows orange for approximately 2 seconds before Quiff pulls it away and casts the bag dramatically toward the classroom's bookshelf. Whatever is inside the bag begins to smoke and rustle. Everyone in the room looks at the bag. The smoke gradually thins. The plastic bag withers a little before flopping off the shelf and onto the floor upside down. There is a long silence. Eventually, Becky throws her head back and roars with laughter.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
Quiff has nothing to say anymore. There's no way he can take back what just happened. I think this is just about the stupidest thing I have ever seen.
This is Solitaire's grand finale?
Becky continues to laugh.
Oh my God! You really are the most deluded of all the hipsters I've met. You bring a whole new meaning to the word deluded.
Quiff lifts a lighter and sways a little toward the bag, as if he's going to try again. But Becky grabs him violently by the wrist and with her other hand wrenches the gun away. She waves it in the air and withdraws her phone from her coat pocket.
Take one step toward that plastic bag, bitch, and I'm calling the popo.
She raises her eyebrows like a disappointed teacher.
Don't think I don't know your name, Erin Riley.
Quiff, or Erin Riley, or whoever, squares up to her.
You think they'd believe some slag?
Becky throws her head back for the second time.
Oh, man. I've met so many Bellends like you.
She pats Quiff on the arm.
You do the whole tough guy thing really well, mate. Well done.
I steal a quick glance at Lucas, but he's just staring at Becky, absently shaking his head.
You're all the same, says Becky. All you idiots who think that by playing the self-righteous intellect, you rule the entire world. Why don't you go home and complain about it on your blog,
like normal people. She takes a step toward him.
I mean, what are you trying to do here, dude? What's Solitaire trying to do? Do you all think that you're better than everyone else? Are you trying to say that school isn't important? Are you trying to teach us about morals and how to be a better person? Are you trying to say that if we just laugh about it all, if we just stir up some shit and put smiles on our faces, then life's going to be hunky-dory? Is that what Solitaire's trying to do?
She lets out a monstrous cry of exasperation, actually making me jump.
Sadness is a natural human emotion, you giant dick.
Evelyn, who has been watching with her lips pursed the entire time, finally speaks up.
Why are you judging us? You don't even understand what we're doing.
Oh, Evelyn, really? Solitaire? You're with Solitaire? Becky begins to flick the lighter on and off. Perhaps she's as deranged as I am. Evelyn cowers backward.
And this prick has been your special secret boyfriend all along. He's wearing more hair product than I've used in the past year, Evelyn.
She shakes her head like a weary old person.
Solitaire. Bloody hell, I feel like I'm in year 8 all over again. Why are you acting like such a special snowflake? Says Evelyn. You think you're a better person than us?
Becky screeches with laughter and tucks a lighter gun into her pajama trousers.
A better person? Ah, I've done some shitty things to people, and now I'm admitting it. You know what, Evelyn? Maybe I want to be a special snowflake. Maybe sometimes I just want to express the emotions that I'm actually feeling instead of having to put on this happy, smiley facade that I put on every day just to come across to bitches like you as not boring.
She points at me again as if she's punching the air.
Apparently, Tori understands what you guys are trying to do. I have no idea why you're trying to destroy our crappy little school. But Tori thinks that, you know, on the whole, you're doing something bad and I fucking believe her.
Her arm drops.
Dear God, Evelyn, you severely piss me off. Jesus Christ.
Creepers are the ugliest shoes I have ever seen. Go back to your blog or Glastonbury or wherever you came from and stay there. Quiff and Evelyn take one last horrified glare at Becky before giving up. It's kind of remarkable in a way. Because people are very stubborn and they don't like to be proven wrong. I think that they both knew that what they were about to do was wrong, though, or they didn't have the guts to go through with it deep down. Maybe, when it came down to it, they'd never been the real antagonists. But if they're not, then who is? We follow the pair slowly out of the room and down the corridor. We watch as they wander away out through the double doors. If I were them, I would probably change schools immediately. They will be gone in a minute. Gone forever. They will be gone. We stay there for a while, not saying anything. After a few minutes, I begin to sweat. Maybe I feel angry. No, I don't feel anything. Lucas is standing next to me, and he turns. His eyes are big and blue and dog-like.
Why did you come here, Victoria?
Those two would have hurt you, I point out. But we both know this isn't true.
Why did you come?
Everything's so blurry. Lucas sighs.
Well, it's finally over. Becky kind of saved us all.
Becky seems to be having a kind of stunned breakdown, slumped on the floor against the wall with her Superman-logoed legs sprawled out in front of her. She holds a lighter gun up to her face, flicking it on and off in front of her eyes.
and I can just about hear her muttering. This is the most pretentious novelty lighter I've ever seen. This is so pretentious.
Am I forgiven? Asks Lucas.
Maybe I'm going to pass out.
I shrug.
You're not actually in love with me, are you?
He blinks, and he's not looking at me.
No.
It wasn't love, really. It was... I just thought I needed you. For some reason.
He shakes his head.
I actually think that Becky's rather lovely.
I try not to throw up or stab myself with my house keys. I stretch my face into a grin like a toy clown.
Ha ha ha, you and the rest of the solar system.
Lucas's expression changes, like he finally gets who I am.
Could you not call me Victoria anymore? I ask.
He steps away from me.
Yeah, sure, Tori.
I start to feel hot.
Were they going to do what I think they were going to do?
Lucas's eyes keep moving around, not looking at me.
They were going to burn the school down, he says.
It seems almost funny. Another childhood dream. If we were 10, perhaps we'd rejoice in the idea of the school on fire, because that would mean no more school, wouldn't it? But it just seems violent and pointless now. As violent and pointless as all the other things that Solitaire has done. And then I realize something. I turn around.
Where are you going? Asks Lucas.
I walk down the corridor back to Kent's classroom, getting hotter and hotter the closer I get.
What are you doing?
I gaze into the classroom, and I wonder if I've lost it entirely.
Tori?
I turn to Lucas and look at him standing at the other end of the corridor. Really, properly look at him.
Get out,
I say, maybe too quietly.
What? Take Becky and get out.
Wait, what are you? And then he sees the orange glow lighting up one side of my body. The orange glow coming from the fire that is raging through Kent's classroom.
Holy shit, says Lucas.
And then I'm racing down the corridor toward the nearest fire extinguisher, tugging at it, but it won't come off the wall. There's a horrific crack. The door to the classroom has split and is burning happily. Lucas has joined me at the extinguisher, but however hard we tug, we can't get it off the wall. The fire creeps out of the room and spreads to the wall displays, the ceiling filling steadily with smoke.
We need to get out, Lucas shouts over the roaring flames. We can't do anything.
Yes, we can. We have to. We have to do something. I have to do something. I abandon the extinguisher and head farther into the school. There'll be another one in the next corridor, in the science corridor. Becky has leapt up from the floor. She goes to run after me, as does Lucas, but a giant wall display suddenly flops off the wall in a fiery wreck of paper and pins, blocking the corridor.
I can't see them. The carpet catches light, and the flames begin to advance toward me.
Tori! Someone screams. I don't know who. I don't care. I locate the fire extinguisher, and this one easily detaches from the wall. It says water on it, but also do not use on burning liquid fires or live electrical equipment. The fire edges down the corridor. On the walls, the ceiling, the floor, pushing me backward. There are lights, plug sockets everywhere.
Tori!
This time the voice comes from behind me. Two hands place themselves on my shoulders and I leap around as if it's death itself. But it's not.
It's him. In his t-shirt and jeans. Glasses, hair, arms, legs, eyes, everything. It's Michael Holden. He wrenches the extinguisher from my arms and he hurls it out of the nearest window. Chapter 15. I am forced down the corridor and thrown out of the nearest fire exit. How Michael knew we were here, I don't know. What's he doing? I don't know. But I need to stop that fire. I need to be in there. If I can't do anything, then it will have been for nothing. My whole life, everything, nothing. He tries to grab me, but I'm practically a torpedo. I race back through the fire exit and down the next corridor, away from the oncoming flames, searching for another fire extinguisher. I'm sort of hyperventilating and I can't see anything, and I'm running so fast that I have no idea where this corridor is in the school, and I start tearing up again. But Michael can run like he skates. He grabs me around the waist just as I tug the fire extinguisher off the wall, just as the fire bypasses the fire exit and closes us in.
Tori, we need to get out now.
The fire draws Michael's face out of the dark. I flail around in his grip and burst forward, but he closes his fist around my forearm and squeezes it and starts to drag me. And before I know what I'm doing, I'm yanking my arm so hard that my skin starts to burn. I'm screaming at him and pushing, and I swing my leg around and actually kick him in the stomach. I must kick him hard, because he tumbles backward and clutches his body. I instantly realize what I've done and freeze, looking at him in the orange light. We meet each other's eyes, and he seems to realize something. And I want to laugh because, yeah, he's finally realized, just like Lucas did eventually. And I hold my arms out to him. And then I see the fire. The inferno in the science lab to our right. The science lab that's connected to that English classroom by one single doorway, which the flames must have stormed straight through. I leap forward into Michael and push him away. And the classroom explodes outward. Crumpled tables, chairs, flying fireballs of books. I'm on the ground several meters away, miraculously alive. And I open my eyes but can see nothing. Michael is lost somewhere around me in the smoke. I scramble backward as a chair leg soars past my cheek and scream his name. No way of knowing if he's alive or... I get up and run. Crying? Shouting things. A name? His name? Solitaire's eternal idea. That childhood dream.
Is he dead?
No. I see a shape rise vaguely from the smoke, flailing around before disappearing farther into the school. At one point, I think I hear him calling me, but I might just be imagining it. I scream his name and I'm running again out of the smoke cloud, away from the science corridor. Around the corner, flames have reached an art classroom, and the artwork, hours and hours of it, is melting into globules of fried acrylic and dripping onto the floor. It's so sad that I want to cry. But the smoke has already started that. I start to panic, too. Not because of the fire. Not even because I'm losing and Solitaire is winning. Because Michael is in here. Another corridor. Another. Where am I? Nothing is the same in the dark and the burning. Epileptic lights flash around me like sirens, like I'm passing out. Diamonds sparkling. I'm screaming again. Michael Holden. The fire growls and a hurricane of hot air careers through the school's tunnels. I call out for him. I'm calling him over and over again. I'm shaking so hard. The artwork and the handwritten essays on the walls are disintegrating around me and I cannot breathe. I failed,
I say these words right as I'm thinking them. It's funny. This never happens. I failed. I failed. It's not the school I failed. It's not even myself. It's Michael. I failed him. I failed to stop being sad. He tried so hard. He tried so hard to be nice, to be my friend. And I failed him. I stopped screaming. There is nothing now. Michael, dead. The school, dying. And me. There is nothing now. And then, a voice. My name in the smoke. I spin on the spot, but there are only flames that way. What building am I in? There must be a window, a fire exit, something, but everything is burning. The smoke slowly starting to suffocate the air, and eventually me. So before I know what I'm doing, I'm tearing up a flight of stairs onto the second floor, smoke and flames at my heels. I turn left, left again, right, into a classroom. The door slams behind me. I grab a chair, not thinking about anything except fire and smoke and dying, and smash the thin window. I close my eyes as a sprinkling of glass dust showers over my hair. I climb out into the morning and onto the top of what seems to be a concrete roof, and finally, finally, I remember where I am. The beautiful place. The small concrete roof of the art conservatory. The field of snow and the river. The black morning sky. Cold air. Infinite space. A thousand thoughts at once. Michael Holden is 900 of them. The rest are self-hatred. I failed to do anything. I look at the smashed window. What does that lead to? Only pain. I look at the metal stairs to my right. What do they lead to? Only myself failing time and time again to do anything right or say anything right. I'm at the edge and I look down. It's far. It's calling me. A hope of something better. A third option. It's so hot. I take my coat and gloves off. It hits me then. I haven't ever known what I wanted out of life. Until now. I sort of want to be dead. Chapter 16. My feet drift absently closer to the edge. I think about Michael Holden, mainly about how he's secretly angry all the time. I think that a lot of people are secretly angry all the time. I think about Lucas Ryan, and that makes me feel sadder. There is another tragedy in which I am not the rescuer. I think about my ex-best friend, Becky Allen. I don't think I know who she is. I think I knew before we grew up. But after that, she changed, and I didn't. I hope that I can understand why one day. I think about my brother, Charlie Spring, and Nick Nelson. Sometimes paradise isn't what people think it should be. I think about Ben Hope. Sometimes people hate themselves. And while I think, Harvey Green Grammar School dissolves. My feet peep slightly over the concrete roof. If I fall accidentally, the universe will be there to catch me. And then? Then there he is. Charlie Spring. A lone dot in orange-tinted white. He's waving and screaming up. Don't! Don't, he says. And there's another figure running along. Taller, stouter. He clutches Charlie's hand. Nick Nelson. Then another, and another.
Why? What's wrong with people? Why do they never give you any peace?
There's Lucas and Becky. Becky puts her hands on her mouth. Lucas puts his hands on his head. Charlie's screaming in battle with the wind and flames. Screaming, whirling, burning.
Stop!
This voice is closer and comes from above. I decide that it is probably God, because I think that this is probably how God works. He waits until your final moments, and then he'll step in and take you seriously. It's like when you're 4 years old and you tell your parents that you're going to run away, and they say, okay, go right ahead, like they don't care. And they only start caring when you actually walk out the door and down the road with your teddy bear under your arm and a packet of biscuits in your rucksack.
Tori.
I turn around and look up. At the top of the school building, above the window that I smashed, is Michael Holden, lying on his front over the roof, so that only his head and shoulders are visible from below. He holds out an arm to me.
Please.
The mere sight of him makes me want to die even more. The school's burning down, I say, turning back the other way. You need to leave.
Turn around, Tori. Turn around, you absolute twat.
Something wrenches me around. I take out my torch, wondering briefly why I haven't used it until now, and I shine it upward. I see him then, properly, hair all messed up and dusty, patches of soot smothering his face, a burn mark on his outstretched arm. Do you want to kill yourself? He asks. And the question sounds unreal, because you never hear anyone ever asking that question in real life. I don't want you to do that, he says. I can't let you do that. You can't leave me here alone.
His voice breaks. You need to be here, he says. And then he does that thing that I do. His mouth sort of sucks itself in and turns down, and his eyes and nose crinkle up, and one tear creeps out of the corner of his blue eye, and he raises his hands to cover up his face. I'm sorry, I say, because his face, all scrunched up and melting, physically hurts me. I start to cry too. Against my will, I step away from the edge and closer to him, and I hope that this makes him understand. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Shut up. He's smiling while crying, madly, throwing his hands from his face and raising both arms up. Then he punches the ground.
God, I'm stupid. I can't believe I didn't realize this any sooner. I can't believe it. I'm pretty much directly under his face. His glasses begin to slide off his nose, and he swiftly pushes them back on. You know, the worst thing is that when I threw away that fire extinguisher you were holding, I wasn't just thinking about saving you, he chuckles sadly. We all need saving, really.
Then why?
I pause. Suddenly understanding everything. This boy, this person. How has it taken me this long to understand? He needed me as much as I needed him, because he was angry, and he has always been angry. You wanted the school to burn. He chuckles again and rubs his eyes. You do know me. And he's right. I do know him. Just because someone smiles doesn't mean that they're happy.
I've never been good enough, he says. I get so stressed out. I don't make friends. God, I can't make friends.